It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Next week, the U.S. Supreme Court considers a question that may reach right into your pocket or to your hand, wherever you're holding your cell phone. The question is whether personal text messages sent over electronic devices supplied by an employer are private. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg has more.
The facts of this case are not in dispute. When the Ontario, California Police Department issued pagers to its SWAT team, the lieutenant in charge first told team members that the pagers would be covered like email on the department computer. No privacy. But the lieutenant later told his subordinates that as long as they paid for any personal messages beyond the 25,000-character limit per month, the department would consider the messages private and would not review them. After a few months, though, the lieutenant got tired of being what he called a bill collector, and the police chief decided the department should review the messages sent by the highest volume users to see if the job required more free message capacity. The department then asked the pager service to provide transcripts, and a review showed that the biggest text messenger, Sergeant Jeff Kwan, had exchanged hundreds of sexually explicit messages with his estranged wife, his girlfriend, and a fellow SWAT officer. Kwan did pay for the messages, so he and the three other people he'd exchanged texts with sued the department. A federal appeals court ruled that the department had violated the texter's reasonable expectation of privacy because the officers had been led to believe by a supervisor that they could use their pagers for personal, private use. The police department appealed to the Supreme Court, which will hear arguments in the case next week. The eventual decision could have huge repercussions because this is the first case testing privacy rights in the Internet age, and while this particular case involves text messages, its reasoning is likely to apply to email, Facebook messages, maybe even surfing the web. The constitutional nub of the case is the Fourth Amendment ban on unreasonable government searches and whether this sort of text monitoring violates the privacy rights of government employees. Much broader, says George Washington law professor Orrin Kerr, is this question. What about the privacy rights of people with whom the texter is communicating? Here, for example, one of the people Sergeant Kwan was texting did not even work for the Ontario Police Department.
Does the government violate your rights when they take those messages off the server, even though you're not the government employee? And what does that mean for the rest of us who do have privacy rights when the government wants to get copies of those communications?
Dieter DeMeyer, who represents Sergeant Kwan and those he was exchanging text messages with, argues that without an explicit policy that covered pagers, which the police department did not have, this kind of monitoring was unreasonable.
They were led to believe by the lieutenant that as long as they paid the overages, then nobody would be looking at their private conversations.
Rebutting that argument, the police department's lawyer, Kent Richland, contends that anyone communicating via police department equipment, whether they're sending out messages, receiving messages, or sending back messages, should assume that nothing is private.
Our point here is that when you're communicating on a police department equipment, whether it's, you know, a pager or email to the police department computers, you can expect that the department may in fact have to look at the nature of those communications.
Richland points out that in both civil and criminal litigation involving police departments, lawyers will typically ask for all communications that took place over a period of several days. But while police departments may portray themselves as special, so too do other government agencies. The National School Boards Association, for instance, has filed a brief contending that it would be dangerous if school officials could not monitor text messages between teachers and students. And however the Supreme Court rules in this case, it's likely that private employers will take cues from the decision, too. So I asked Richland just how many of the justices can actually send text messages themselves.
That's a very good question. I honestly don't know the answer to that.
Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
No matter how many justices may be texting, there are many tech-savvy people here in the nation's capital. And this spring, hundreds are testing new gadgets that allow them to watch local TV on their mobile phones or laptops. In part, this mobile digital television is an effort by broadcasters to reach more viewers. But the broadcasters are also sending a message to Congress. Let us keep our airwaves. As reporter Joel Rose explains, the Federal Communications Commission wants them to give up some of those airwaves.
Mobile digital television is already on the air in a handful of markets around the country. The devices that allow you to watch that signal aren't actually for sale yet. but I'm getting a sneak peek here in Washington's DuPont Circle.
What we're trying to do is assess, you know, consumers' interest to make this a better service, to understand what they want to watch, where they want to watch it, and how they want to watch it.
And Shelley directs the Open Mobile Video Coalition.
Is it more at home that they're watching it? Is it in a beautiful park that we're sitting in today that they're watching it?
Shelley's organization was created by broadcasters to help make mobile TV a reality. The coalition handed out prototype gadgets to roughly 1,000 users in the Washington area. One looks just like a phone with a shiny little TV antenna. Another is a cute pink box that can turn any iPhone or laptop into a portable TV.
Two canine siblings are safe and sound together at home.
And it's all because of a little puppy love in New Hampshire.
Broadcasters are hoping these new devices can bring viewers, especially younger ones, back to live local TV. The number of American households that only get over-the-air TV has shrunk to about 12 million as viewers flee for cable and the internet. On top of that, the FCC wants TV stations to give up part of their airwaves so that wireless companies can use them to deliver high-speed internet access. Here's how FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski put it during an interview last month.
The team has developed a win-win strategy that creates a mechanism, an auction, that will get spectrum on the market and that will allow broadcasters on a voluntary basis to say, hey, we actually would like to take advantage of the opportunity to share spectrum.
I have not heard one broadcaster step up and say, yes, I'm interested in that.
Dennis Wharton is executive vice president of the National Association of Broadcasters. Back in DuPont Circle, he says the country's TV stations just spent billions of dollars on the switch to digital TV, in the process freeing up lots of spectrum for wireless companies.
Yet now the FCC is saying we want broadcasters to give back 120 megahertz more. Well, the reality is if you do that, you're going to take away a lot of TV stations across the United States.
The FCC doesn't think so. Because digital signals are more efficient than analog signals, it's possible to fit several digital TV channels in the airwave space of one analog channel. But Perry Sook isn't ready to give up his extra spectrum. Sook is chairman of Nexstar Broadcasting Group, which owns or operates 62 stations in mid-sized markets around the country.
We are less than a year past the digital transition where the broadcasters basically gave up about 25% of the spectrum they were using on an analog basis. I think there are a lot of companies that are thinking about opportunities to use the spectrum, what the highest and best use of. I think only time will tell.
Broadcasters say they might need the extra spectrum for mobile TV, but it might not matter because wherever you're watching broadcast TV, you're still just passively watching whatever is on. And increasingly, viewers want to decide what to watch and when.
They want to go to a website of some sort and pick what they want to see at that moment.
Rory Altman is the director of the consulting firm Altman Valandry & Company. He thinks the future of video distribution is online, not over the air. Altman thinks broadcasters know this, too.
And they will hold out until Congress gives them a really significant share of any auction proceeds.
But broadcasters insist there's still a place for old-school, over-the-air TV. They're betting that once consumers get their hands on mobile TV, their viewing habits will start to change. And Shelley at the Open Mobile Video Coalition says hers did.
During the day, who watches TV, right? Well, now I do. Seriously, I've watched more Ellen DeGeneres in the last month on these devices.
The question is, how many other people will want to spend a beautiful afternoon in the park watching TV? For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
First it was Haiti, then Chile, then Mexico, and this week, China. Doesn't it seem like there have been an unusual number of earthquakes lately? Well, the short answer is there haven't. It's just that by coincidence, they've been happening in more populated areas this year. And scientists who study earthquakes have been looking for ways to install more sensors in vulnerable places to capture crucial data, and also, perhaps, to give people a few precious seconds of advanced warning. Well, we asked one of our producers, Travis Larchuk, to find out what they've come up with. And Travis, what have they come up with?
Well, here it is, Guy. This is an earthquake monitor.
Which is, to me, and I would assume to most people, is your laptop. It looks like your laptop computer.
Well, it is a laptop computer. But the cool thing about it is this software that I installed. Check it out here.
Okay, so I'm looking at your screen right now, and there's like a what looks like an EKG monitor, or anyone who's seen a seismograph on TV after an earthquake can see that it's just sort of four sort of straight lines moving down the screen.
Yeah, they're pretty flat right now, right. But watch this.
Oh, wow. So when we bang on the table, they kind of spike up and down. And
yeah, just like a seismograph during an earthquake would do. And this is all the idea of Elizabeth Cochran. She's a geoscientist at the University of California, Riverside. And one day she was just thinking about these accelerometers that are built into newer laptop computer
and
models.
And an accelerometer, I should mention, because you told me this, is basically a motion detector in a computer.
Right. And the reason it's inside of these laptop computers is so it can detect whether you've dropped your computer, and then it'll switch off the hard drive to help protect data.
So as soon as I knew that there were these low-cost sensors inside the accelerometers, I thought it would be perfect to use them to network together and actually record earthquakes.
So Elizabeth Cochran got in touch with a colleague at Stanford, and they whipped up a program that anyone can download for free and install, and it's silently waiting to detect tremors.
So it just waits for a tremor, but sort of practically speaking, how do they work?
All right, well, let's pretend we're sitting in a coffee shop in San Francisco. And you're working on your laptop computer, just like all the other hipsters in there.
I just ordered a soy macchiato on my iPad.
And all of a sudden, the whole place starts to shake. It's not too bad, maybe a 4.5. But the whole time, the Quake Catcher software has been capturing the data from the motion sensor in your laptop computer. And then the program sends a quick little note to the main server saying, hey, heads up, something's going on here.
And when our server receives a bunch of those, we then say, this is a likely earthquake.
That's the Stanford geoscientist. His name's Jesse Lawrence. But the thing is, right now, there are only around 1,000 people across the world who are actually running this program.
So if it's just 1,000 people, how useful is the program now?
It's not extremely useful, but the goal is for them to get 10,000 people just in California alone. And that's because the more people you have, the better this thing works.
Mm. If you can detect an event fast enough, then you can potentially provide advanced alert to surrounding areas, and those surrounding areas could react within several seconds and get to safety.
And for people who don't have fancy laptop computers, they've also worked up an external accelerometer you can plug into your computer's USB drive. They're installing a lot of those in schools now, actually.
And if the whole thing, you know, runs on these accelerometers, presumably it could work on iPhones too, because when you, as you know, when you turn them, there's a motion sensor to detect which way you're holding the phone.
Right, and I did ask Jesse Lawrence about that.
There is a potential to use the accelerometers in smartphones. We've been investigating that.
He says it's tricky to figure out right now because the phone's usually in your pocket and they don't want to detect a false earthquake every time you go to sit down.
Right.
But imagine what they could do if every smartphone in California were linked into this network.
That's very, very cool. That's our producer, Travis Larchuk. And Travis, I assume there is a link on our website to the Quake Catcher Network?
Yep, it's there at npr.org.
Thanks, Travis.
No problem, guy.
OMG. The Library of Congress wants to archive my tweets and your tweets and every public tweet ever. I found out about it on Twitter this week, which will please Andy Carbon, senior strategist for NPR's social media desk, and he's here in the studio. Andy, really, every tweet, even, you know, the what I had for breakfast ones?
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They're grabbing the whole kit and caboodle.
I mean, first of all, the Library of Congress is the oldest federal cultural institution.
Right.
Why does it believe tweets are important enough to archive?
Twitter, in many ways, has become the pulse of what's going on online right now. Because it's a real-time conversation that anyone can chime into at any given point, it's 24/7, and so when something happens somewhere in the world, you're almost guaranteed that people will be talking about it or even witnessing it as it happens, whether it's protests and revolution in Kyrgyzstan to people talking about the ham sandwich they just ate and everything in between.
But to quote Carl Sagan, there are billions and billions of tweets. I mean, how are they going to do this?
Yeah,
how is
tens and tens of millions of tweets per day. So on the one hand, it's just a matter of storing all this stuff and having enough space to keep it all. But then the big question will be, what kind of tools will they have available for researchers to parse through all of it and find what they're looking for? And that may not be a stretch either, because there are a whole range of third-party tools out there right now that will allow a person to go online, search for tweets, and And so there are already ways that any of us on any given day can go and find information we're looking for.
A librarian of Congress, James Billington, said the Twitter Digital Archive has extraordinary potential for research into our contemporary way of life. What do you think tweets are going to tell us about ourselves in 100 years?
I don't know. I think people are going to be surprised and have forgotten that President Bieber used to be a singer before he got into politics. beyond that, Twitter captures everything, and you're going to get a sampling of what life was like at its most mundane and banal and at its most tense and exciting and disturbing, because it really is just a reflection on what's going on at any given moment. And so it makes research rather onerous in some ways, but at the same time, historians and archaeologists are always often looking for the mundane because you can't always tell what everyday people were doing. Twitter, not only does it operate 24/7, it has tens of millions of people participating in it. And so suddenly it democratizes the snapshotting of the world in a way that's never been done before. It's the famous, it's the infamous that get captured for posterity, and now we're going to have a little bit of everything.
Andy Carvin is senior strategist for NPR's social media desk. Andy, thanks a lot. Don't forget to tweet.
Certainly won't.
This is NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. First, Avatar conquered the box office, and on Thursday it makes a play for your living room on DVD and Blu-ray. But the release will be in regular 2D, not 3D. You'll have to wait until the holidays for the extra dimension. Ever since the film arrived in theaters, there's been a race to bring 3D technology to screens big and small. And as NPR's Art Silverman reports, stereoscopic viewing is no longer a guilty pleasure only for the secular world.
I went to an exhibition of 3D TV here in Washington, D.C., and I was impressed watching perspiring men shoot hoops, climbers descend into the Grand Canyon, and 3D fish swim about.
It makes you feel like you're truly in the ocean.
That's fellow gawker Darren Dedre of Tyson's Corner, Virginia. So, if 3D technology can take us under the water, could it let us see someone special walk on the water?
Welcome to 3DCatholicTV.com. We're glad you stopped by.
Catholic TV out of Boston has gone 3D.
I'm Father Reed, and these are my 3D glasses.
So far, so good. But here's the trouble. There's no storytelling. Catholic TV's website is mostly travelogue. Walks through St. Peter's Square or tours of the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception. I expect 3D to give me some spectacular vision.
I would show the transformations of the body of Christ.
That's Professor Angela Zito. She's the co-director of the Center for Religion and Media at New York University. While Zito wishes the Catholic video outlet was generating more vivid content, she's not at all surprised that the church has embraced 3D.
Printing was actually invented by Chinese Buddhists in order to produce sutras.
What excites Zito about the potential of 3D for religion is that the technology allows us to see the unseeable.
Our imaginations don't work in a vacuum. They actually require a kind of vehicle or something to inspire them. And I don't think that this is going to limit our imaginations. I think it's going to concretize more seductively the things that we can imagine.
Once Catholic TV lets us use our imaginations more, it will have greater impact on viewers. Catholic TV's father, Robert Reed, says that at this point, 3D TV is still just a gimmick for them.
Considering the fact that our faith has so many dimensions, it just seemed sensible to me to look at 3D and to see what we could do with it right now and how we could use it in the future.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining me to pray the glorious mysteries of the Holy Rosary of the Blessed Virgin Mary. Today, we are standing here in Piazza San Pietro.
For now, Catholic TV has the future to itself. No other religion has 3D plans. Not the Mormons, not the Baptists, not the Muslims, not the Hindus. Even the Jews are still operating in 2D.
In the past, 3D came and went. I am very skeptical.
That's Rabbi Mark Golub, president and executive producer of Shalom TV.
We are still, you know, sort of, we're horse and buggy here. The Jewish community has focused all of its attention in the past on print and the print media. We are the people of the book.
And Rabbi Golub has no envy about being beaten to 3D by a Catholic TV outlet.
The Catholics have always beat the Jews.
So for now, Catholic TV has the field all to itself, hoping that if they can capture the eyeballs of viewers, the hearts and souls will follow. Art Silverman, NPR News.
And staying with your TV for another few moments now.
By the way, you might want to put on a bathing suit, because you'll be channel surfing in no time.
That's Jim Carrey from the 1996 comedy The Cable Guy. But channel surfing with a traditional remote might be going the way of the 8-track. I'm joined now by our tech expert, Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. And Omar, you are issuing another warning. You warned us when smartphones began replacing standalone GPS units. And now you think the remote control might also be headed towards the endangered gadgets list. Why is that?
This one, people might be a little bit happier about losing when you've got four or five remotes in the living room cluttering up everything. Yeah, I think as smartphones are becoming more ubiquitous and we're walking around with these touchscreen devices with us wherever we go, I'm thinking that that's probably where remote control technology is going to go. You've got this with you all the time, and you're now able to use apps to control lots of devices in your living room.
Okay, well, let's assume that we do have a DVD player, a TV, a cable box, maybe a game console. How would a smartphone communicate with all of those pieces of equipment?
Well, there have been quite a few apps that have come out in the last year, not just for the iPhone and the iPod Touch, but also for the Android phones and for BlackBerry and Palm, that allow you to connect over Wi-Fi with either a computer that's hooked up to the TV, say you want to view Hulu videos or Netflix. Now, where things get a little bit trickier is when there's no computer involved and you're just controlling the TV and the other devices and you need something like a universal remote. There are starting to be some hardware devices that are sort of the go-between between your phone and those devices that either beam an IR signal to them or find some other way to do it if your devices are internet-enabled.
IR meaning infrared?
Absolutely. And there's one device that I've been trying out lately called the Red Eye, which is an app and a hardware device that beams a signal to these devices and kind of doubles as a remote control. There's still some things about it that don't quite work, but I definitely see that that's where things are going. You're going to have your smartphone with you all the time. It allows multiple people in the house to control all the same devices if they have the same app installed. And you're much less likely to lose your smartphone, I think, than to lose, you know, four or five remotes that you might have around.
But if you're thinking about setting this up and operating it, Omar, how foolproof is it? How easy is it for those of us who are not too technically adept?
That's the problem that I encountered is I'm used to a Logitech Harmony remote, which is kind of a real remote control with a little screen on it that tells you what the activities are, like watch TV or listen to a CD. And that required quite a bit of setup. These apps are at work in somewhat the same way. You have to tell it what devices you own. You have to kind of go in and configure the buttons that you want on it. And that can be a really long, painstaking procedure. And with the Red Eye device that I tried, which is a little kind of an iPod dock that also beams those signals, you also have to set it up on a Wi-Fi network, and that involves a whole kind of rigmarole as well. As these databases get bigger with the names of more devices and these IR codes, it's going to get a little bit easier, but definitely this is kind of an all-day weekend project to get all this set up the way you want it and to turn on the devices the way you want, and it's not quite there yet, but definitely something to look at in the future.
Okay, Omar, thanks so much. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me. And we will have links to a lot of these products and apps on the All Tech Considered blog at npr.org/alltech.
That's Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman and joins us most Mondays on All Tech Considered.